Hi, I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now! For more than 15 years, CJSF 90.1 FM has been bringing Democracy Now! To the greater Vancouver area every weekday at 11 a.m. From New York, this is Democracy Now!
We have in our lifetime, from Iraq to that last 20 years in Afghanistan, fought wars that everybody, right, left, everybody gets now, were spectacular moral as well as military failures for no other reason than that anything else would have cut into those $6.5 trillion profits of the defense industry.
It's primary day in New Hampshire as Donald Trump and Nikki Haley square off in the Republican race. We'll speak to Democratic presidential candidate Marianne Williamson about her long shot campaign against President Biden. She's calling for a Department of Peace. In an unusual twist, Williamson's name is on today's New Hampshire ballot, but Biden's is not. Biden opted out of running in New Hampshire after the state refused to move its primary until after South Carolina's. We'll also speak to the acclaimed Chinese artist Ai Weiwei, who recently had an exhibition in London canceled after he publicly criticized Israel's assault on Gaza. But first, we go to a tent facility built at a former airport in New York where 2,000 migrants had to face sub-freezing temperatures this weekend.
We're in this tent where we don't have a bed, but at least we have cots to sleep. If not, we'd be sleeping in the street. We don't have a way to wash our clothes. The food is not great, but at least it's a warm meal.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Israel's reportedly proposed halting its assault on Gaza for 2 months in exchange for the release of more than 100 hostages remaining in Gaza. According to Axios, the proposed deal would also involve the release of Palestinians imprisoned by Israel, but it would not end the war in Gaza. Axios reports Israel's given the proposal to Hamas through mediators from Qatar and Egypt. Separately, CNN reports Israel proposed allowing top Hamas officials to leave Gaza as part of a broader ceasefire negotiation. President Biden's Middle East coordinator Brett McGurk is in Egypt and will soon head to Qatar. This comes as Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu faces increasing political pressure to bring home the hostages. Earlier today, Israel announced 24 of its soldiers were killed in Gaza on Monday in the deadliest day for Israeli forces since Hamas attacked Israel on October 7th, bringing the number of Israeli soldier casualties to over 200. Meanwhile, the humanitarian crisis in Gaza continues to worsen. The United Nations is warning 570,000 Palestinians face catastrophic hunger. Health officials in Gaza say 195 Palestinians were killed in Israeli strikes over the past 24 hours. Israeli forces have reportedly surrounded the city of Khan Yunis while attacking areas where thousands of Palestinians have sought shelter, including at Al-Aqsa University. This is a Palestinian child who fled the school with his family.
We hardly made it out of the university under the shelling. We didn't expect the tanks at the university's gates. We hardly made it out. Every day I see children die. Every day children die. Many of my friends died last night at Al-Aqsa University.
According to the Gaza Health Ministry, over 25,000 Palestinians have died in Gaza, more than 10,000 of them children. In other news from the region, the 18-year-old Israeli war resistor Tal Mitnick has been sentenced to an additional 30 days in military prison. Visit democracynow.org to see our interview with Mitnick last week. He's the first Israeli resistor in the Gaza assault. The U.S. and U.K. launched fresh strikes on 8 Houthi targets in Yemen Monday. It's the second time the two countries conducted a joint attack and the 8th strike by U.S. forces against the Iran-backed Houthi movement in Yemen over the past 2 weeks in retaliation for Houthi forces targeting ships in the Gulf of Aden and Red Sea to protest Israel's war on Gaza. Massive protests have filled the streets of Yemen since the foreign attack started and after the U.S. recently redesignated the Houthi movement as a terrorist group. This is journalist and activist Issa Al-Sayani.
We say to the United States that this classification will not cause the Yemeni people any fears regarding their support of Gaza. This classification is an evasion and cover-up by the United States and Israel for the crimes they committed against the Palestinian people.
Here in the United States, the Service Employees International Union, SEIU, has become the largest U.S. union to call for an immediate Gaza ceasefire. Union President Mary Kay Henry said, quote, SEIU's almost 2 million members believe that wherever violence, fear and hatred thrive, working people cannot, she said, adding Israel must also, quote, end decades of occupation, blockades and lack of freedom endured by the Palestinian people. The U.S. Supreme Court has declined to hear a case brought against the organization U.S. Campaign for Palestinian Rights. The decision upholds lower court rulings that rejected baseless claims the Palestinian advocacy group provides material support for terrorism. The Center for Constitutional Rights, which represents the group, welcomed the Supreme Court move and said, quote, as the government of Israel is carrying out an unfolding genocide against Palestinians in Gaza, it's more important than ever that activists be free to speak out without fear, CCR said. In more Supreme Court news, justices agreed Monday to hear an appeal from Oklahoma death row prisoner Richard Glossop. He's maintained his innocence for over a quarter of a century after being convicted as the mastermind behind the 1997 murder for hire of his former employer, the owner of a motel Glossop managed. He's narrowly escaped execution 3 times. Oklahoma's Republican Attorney General, Gentner Drummond, has said Glossop's conviction should be vacated due to an unfair trial. In immigration news, the Supreme Court sided with the Biden administration, allowing Border Patrol agents to cut down razor wire put up by Texas troopers along its border with Mexico. Texas Governor Greg Abbott had previously ignored the orders to remove the wire, asserting state authority over the border area. New Hampshire voters are casting ballots today in the first primary of the 2024 presidential election. Former South Carolina Governor Nikki Haley appeared at a flurry of campaign events Monday in what analysts say could be a final attempt to shore up her campaign against frontrunner Donald Trump. On the Democratic side, President Biden will not be on the primary ballot after state Democrats went ahead with January primaries despite the DNC switching up the voting calendar to prevent Iowa and New Hampshire, for two of the whitest states in the country, from being the first to hold their primaries and caucuses. A write-in campaign for Biden still seeks to deliver the president a victory in New Hampshire. Meanwhile, organizers are urging Democrats to instead write in their vote as ceasefire to send a message to Biden over support for Israel's assault on Gaza. One presidential candidate who is on New Hampshire's Democratic ticket is author and activist Marianne Williamson. She'll be joining us to discuss her campaign later in the broadcast. The Biden administration announced new measures to strengthen access to reproductive care on the 51st anniversary of Roe v. Wade Monday. These include making contraception more accessible and free under the Affordable Care Act and ensuring hospitals provide emergency abortions nationwide. Both President Biden and Vice President Kamala Harris gave addresses Monday excoriating Republicans for their continued attack on abortion rights as Democrats seek to harness persistent voter rage over the Supreme Court's undoing of Roe v. Wade in 2022. This is Vice President Harris speaking from the battleground state of Wisconsin as she kicked off a national tour on abortion rights.
In the last 19 months, in states across our nation, extremists have proposed and passed laws that criminalize doctors and punish women. Today in America, 1 in 3 women of reproductive age live in a state with an abortion ban. 1 in 3.
In France, Tens of thousands of people took to the streets in cities across the country on Sunday, urging President Emmanuel Macron to reject a hardline immigration bill. The measure strengthens deportation authority, makes it more difficult for non-citizens to access social welfare and other benefits. The legislation's been widely condemned as anti-immigrant amidst fears of a turn to the far right. This is a migrant worker from Mali at the rally in Paris.
Myself, for example, I work. I don't have social security or anything at all, even though I pay taxes. This is really difficult. When we work, we can be maltreated because we're afraid to lose the jobs that we have. And then when we work, the overtime hours that we do can go unpaid, and we can't complain. You complain, you get fired.
In Illinois, at least 8 people were found fatally shot at 3 separate locations in the city of Joliet Sunday and Monday. The suspected gunman fled to Texas, where police said he shot himself after a confrontation with law enforcement Monday evening. One of the victims was a 28-year-old Nigerian immigrant who'd been living in the U.S. for about 3 years. There's been at least 24 mass shootings in the U.S. just in the first 3 weeks of this year, according to the Gun Violence Archive. Dexter Scott King, the youngest son of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. and Coretta Scott King, has died of prostate cancer at 62. He served as chair of the King Center, where he dedicated his life's work to preserving and sharing the legacy of his parents, inspiring young people to continue working toward justice and equality. And in California, faculty at Cal State University, the country's largest public university system, are returning to the classroom today as they reach a tentative agreement late Monday after just a one-day strike. The deal grants pay raises and extended parental leave, among other things. The California Faculty Association Union celebrated the deal, posting on social media, quote, "In case anyone forgot, strikes work." And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman in New York, joined by Democracy Now! Co-host Juan Gonzalez in Chicago. Hi, Juan.
Hi, Amy, and welcome to all of our listeners and viewers across the country and around the world.
As 9 Democratic governors, led by New York's Governor Kathy Hochul, have joined together to call on President Biden and Congress to address the humanitarian crisis faced by migrants, we begin today's show in New York City, looking at the conditions endured by tens of thousands of asylum seekers who've arrived here over the last year, many on buses from Texas, as part of Republican Governor Greg Abbott's anti-immigrant efforts. On Sunday, a 3-month-old girl staying in a migrant shelter with her family in Queens died after suffering a heart attack. This comes amidst an ongoing housing crisis for migrants and asylum seekers in the city that's left many scrambling for a safe place to live after New York City Mayor Eric Adams imposed a 60-day limit for families to stay in shelters, 30 days for single men. Around 2,000 migrant men, women, and children staying in a remote tent facility built at a former airport called Floyd Bennett Field have faced below-freezing temperatures for days. Democracy Now! Went there Saturday and spoke to Fabiola Mendieta Cuapio, a Brooklyn resident immigrant justice activist organizing essential needs and resources.
The conditions inside are not the best conditions for families. We've been receiving complaints about people getting sick because it's cold. They put the heat. They have heat inside. But still, you know, it's just in the area. The area is cold, isolated. I feel like one of the biggest needs right now, it's not just clothes and food. You know, sometimes people just need to get access or information about the school district, where to go, if they need medical insurance. I know the city has been working with some families, but also I think language access is a huge need inside. We find out that a lot of the families don't get served because they don't speak Spanish. People assume that because they look like me, they speak Spanish. It's not the case. We also have a lot of indigenous families inside these tents. We have families from around the world who speak other, other languages. And I think the language barrier prevents for these families to get the services they need. Another big ask that they have is mental health services. You know, people are really traumatized.
That was immigrant justice activist Fabiola Mendieta Quapio speaking with Democracy Now!'s Tammy Woronoff. Democracy Now! Producer Maria Taracena spoke to an asylum seeker and single mother from Ecuador who's been staying at the Floyd Bennett Field tent camp with her two young daughters since late December. She said her partner had died as they crossed the treacherous Darien jungle between Colombia and Panama en route to the United States. And she said she fled Ecuador after receiving threats from a gang and surviving years of domestic violence. She asked we hide her identity for safety.
Salí el 4 de agosto. Me duré 5 meses.
I left Ecuador on August 4th. It took me 5 months to get here. On my journey to the United States, I was robbed. I was even left without shoes. In Mexico, my 6-year-old daughter was almost kidnapped. I'm grateful to the people who helped me get my daughter back. I didn't have any money to eat. I slept in the streets with my daughters in the cold. Now I'm here in New York with my two daughters. They're both going to school. I haven't been able to look for work because it's very difficult to go drop them off at school and then come back all the way here and then go back out again to pick them up. It takes me all day. I need help to go out and look for a job so that I can start having some stability with my daughters and move on. I am alone here. I don't know anyone. I've worked very hard ever since I was a little girl. People who know me would tell me that I am very hardworking, that I am a fighter who has always taken care of her children. One of my daughters is 6, and the other is 11 years old. I had to take one of them to the hospital recently because she was burning with fever. I got really scared.
Could you please share or describe what the conditions are inside this tent facility? How long have you been here for? And could you describe just how isolated it is? It's about 20 degrees. It's freezing today. What is it like to be sleeping and to be inside the facility?
La verdad aquí, como digo...
To be honest, I don't think I can complain. We're in this tent where we don't have a bed, but at least we have cots to sleep. If not, we'd be sleeping in the street. We don't have a way to wash our clothes. The food is not great, but at least it's a warm meal.
Democracy Now! Producer Maria Inez Taracena speaking with an asylum seeker and mother from Ecuador. She said after arriving in New York, she asked the father of one of her daughters to please send her money for school supplies and other urgent needs, but was scammed. She was scammed by a woman she thought was willing to help her.
Because I don't have a phone number in the United States or a passport, this woman told me to use her information so that my daughter's father could send the money. She withdrew the money, and I begged her to please bring it to me, but she never did.
She described, as she cried, enduring years of domestic violence from her father and several partners in Ecuador, and spoke about her first husband and the father of her older children who are still in Ecuador.
El papá me pegaba, me humillaba.
The father of one of my children beat me. He'd humiliate me and force me to sleep outside in the cold. Before I left him, he tried to stab me and said he'd kill me. I was just 12 years old when I was given to him, and he was 23 years old. I suffered a lot. I barely even grew up with my mom and dad. My father was also very evil towards me. I've asked for help here and asked to be able to speak to a psychologist because the truth is that sometimes I've wanted to die.
For more on the humanitarian crisis endured by asylum seekers in New York and Chicago, we're joined by two guests. In Albany, New York, Murata Walda is with us, executive director of the New York Immigration Coalition and NYIC Action. His Albany Times Union op-ed is headlined, An Opportunity for New York to Lead on Immigration Policy. And in Chicago, Oscar Chacon is executive director of Alianza Americas, an immigrant rights group addressing the arrival of thousands of migrants to Chicago as well. We welcome you both to Democracy Now! We're going to begin with Murad in the capital of New York State, in Albany. Can you talk about what we just saw, these conversations, what's happening out, not only in Queens, but the death of the three-month-old, what's happening to asylum seekers here and what you feel needs to be done?
Well, thank you for having me on your show today. It's a pleasure always to be in your company. It's incredibly unfortunate that we continue to find ourselves in this kind of emergent rapid response moment when we've been welcoming folks, not just for the past 18 months, but as a city of immigrants, a state of immigrants, a state that's been built by every wave of immigration. Our state and our city has been unprepared and continue to stay in this rapid response moment instead of actually putting together plans to actually integrate people better. That's why we're here in Albany today. We're fighting for our state legislative platform, which is to really invest in immigration legal services, expanding housing voucher access, as well as language justice. What's happening in New York City with Mayor Eric Adams is not the ramifications of a migrant crisis. I don't think we have a migrant crisis. I think we have a crisis of leadership in this moment. And every instance of action that this mayor has taken over the past 18 months has not been something that is based in compassion and humanity, as we've been known in New York City to do, but more so as building more barriers and actually making it harder for people to become self-sufficient. The more we support people, the better they are able to stand up on their own without having to be pushed out and evicted from shelters and having to be re-intaked. Even before they put their 30 and 60 day rule in place, what we were seeing is that a good majority of singles were getting out within 30 to 45 days. And this is just putting another burden and another bureaucratic hurdle in their way to actually standing up on their own feet. And we've been dealing with an affordability crisis, not just in New York, but across this country for years. And we are not seeing any action being taken on that from the federal level, nor our state, nor our city. So this is an opportunity for every level of government to step up and lead, and also lead in the arena that they can have power over.
Murad, I wanted to ask you, you mentioned that you don't believe that there is a crisis with the arrival of these asylum seekers. Most people are not aware that New York City, in the 2 years after the pandemic started, lost nearly 500,000 residents who left the city. So you would think that all those people leaving means there are empty apartments, there are empty office buildings. Why has it been so hard for the city to find housing for these asylum seekers?
You know, that's a great question. And we actually lost over 400,000 people since the pandemic. We've had a huge amount of people leaving the state and specifically working class people leaving the state of New York because of the affordability crisis. We have apartments that are being hoarded. We have over 40,000 apartments that are rent stabilized being hoarded. We have several thousand city owned apartments that are owned and operated by the HPD. We have NYCHA, which are public housing units that are available. So this is not an issue of is there availability. Yeah, we should always be building more affordable housing. But in this moment, we have enough housing to house everyone who's currently living in our homeless shelters, as well as those who need supportive housing. We have an enormous amount of supportive housing that's available. This is an administration that continues to fumble the ball and continues to fail at actually leading. You know, they've put in measures that actually don't help anyone in the city of New York, such as hiring freezes. Now we're seeing the mayor blame and scapegoat migrants and immigrants and saying that he has to make these massive budget cuts when we know that he actually stored an enormous amount of surplus money in the rainy day fund and the reserves within the city. And just recently, through our advocacy and our efforts, the governor just announced that she's dedicating over $2.4 billion to the city. And yet he continues to push his austerity measures. This is someone who came in with an austere lens and continues to push that to this day. Even with receiving the resources he needs to ensure that there are no cuts, he continues to champion cutting more social services, essential services, and pretty much harming New Yorkers in the way in which we have been living in New York. And this is our golden opportunity. We have a huge population coming in like they always do every year. And we need this population. We need the workforce. And we need to continue to building our city and our state. And that has only been done by every wave of immigration over the past two centuries here.
I'd like to bring Oscar Chacon in from Alianza Americas. Oscar, Chicago has received about 34,000 asylum seekers in the city from buses and planes sent by Texas in the last year and a half. There are lots of reports that many employers in the Chicago area are actually creating more divisions even among the undocumented community by hiring Venezuelans off the books and getting rid of Mexican and Guatemalan and other undocumented workers. Could you talk about that process, how that's affected the communities involved?
Well, I think it's important to understand that at the core of this problem is the fact that we have millions of people, longtime residents of Chicago and many other cities across the nation, without the status, without the ability to work legally in the U.S. And that is a situation that is taken advantage of by employers who just want to squeeze workers even more. This is something that happens constantly, not only in the context of this particular crisis, but it is often the case that people that employers consider are going to be more docile and more willing to work for less get employed. And this is important also to look from the perspective of how we normally debate about immigrants in the U.S. who are here without authorization and working, because we tend to blame them, but we never look at the employers. And the fact is, there is clearly a reason behind why these people are employed the way they are employed, and it is because employers want to do maximum profit, but we never actually look at the employer angle from this. We tend to just blame immigrants. At the end of all, we need to understand that we have a major failure of leadership, just as Murad was pointing a few minutes ago, from the federal to the state to the city level governments. And it is not a crisis that began over the last couple of years. This is a crisis that has been in many ways brewing for decades. We have created the conditions that makes easy at this point in time to blame, to scapegoat newly arrived asylum seekers as if they were the ones that caused the realities that we are seeing. The fact is, we are a society that doesn't really care about people well-being, and that's what's playing out in the context of people arriving desperately seeking support and protection.
Oscar Chacon, can you talk about how both New York and Chicago are dealing with the migrant crisis? And when I say that, I'm not talking about crisis caused by migrants. For example, Chicago is suing the bus companies, the bus companies are suing Chicago for not letting the buses that the governors in the South are sending north, and New York is suing the bus companies. Is this a diversion? What do you think needs to happen?
Well, I think it's important to understand that in many ways, this is a perfect storm, not from the perspective of immigrants causing it, but a perfect storm in the sense that migrants are unveiling a reality that has been put in place, as I mentioned before, over decades. And essentially, we are still failing to really deal with the root causes of the problem. We hardly ever speak about the simple question of why are these people coming? I think cities like Chicago and New York, in many ways, not so much in terms of governmental leadership, but in terms of civil society organizations, community-based organizations, really stepping up and trying to help in the best way they can. But the reality is we have a big failure in terms of not counting with the right set of policies in place to be able to be helpful. So bus companies in the end are just trying to make money out of this situation. I think cities like New York in particular are very easy moving into blaming immigrants as if they were the ones that caused, you know, these difficulties. The reality is, again, we have a big crisis in terms of not having been really care about providing people housing conditions that are adequate, that are dignified, not providing people access to health care, including mental health care. And again, migrants are simply making these failures in our society very visible. The easiest thing to do is to blame immigrants, but in reality, it is the compounding effect of decades of neglect when it comes to a public policy that really puts at the center of everything.